Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast 64 for Tuesday, August 24th, 2010. I'll be one of your hosts this week. My name is David O'Brien, and with me is...
Dominic Ravier.
Unfortunately, Ben and David Liu are off traveling around the world again this week, but we hope that they'll join us next week. As usual, we have three stories for you, including that Apple has been granted a new and very scary patent on its slide-to-unlock feature. Also, AT&T has issued a statement in support of the Google and Verizon net neutrality agreement. And finally, Oracle has filed suit against Google over its Android operating system. So, diving right into it. This week in tech media, we saw a flurry of blog posts and articles written all about a new patent that was granted to Apple. And this patent covers the slide-to-unlock feature on some of the wireless devices that you commonly find on iPhones and iPod Touches. What's interesting about this, though, is the fact that this is a design patent, and that is much different from a utility patent. Whether you think you have or you haven't, you've probably heard of a utility patent before, because those are the most common patents referred to in the media when the word patent is actually used. A utility patent claims inventive ownership to products, processes, machines, compositions of matter, and items of manufacture. Design patents, however, only protect the non-functional ornamental features of an invention. So Dominic, let's say that you're Apple and you just have been issued this design patent on the slide-to-unlock feature. And let's just say that I'm a huge competitor, and I happen to make a friendly little operating system named Android, and I come out with a very similar slide-to-unlock feature that your phone has, at least in terms of functionality, but it actually doesn't look anything like the slide-to-unlock feature on the iPhone. What does this mean, then, in light of the design patent that you've just been granted? And what types of protection are actually being afforded by the design patent?
This means that functionality has nothing to do with the design patent. A design patent offers no protection for functionality. It just means, look, we have this pretty design. No one else can use this pretty design, but they can do what the design does as long as it just doesn't look the same.
Right. And it's different when you approach a lawsuit. If you have a design patent on something, and you think that there's somebody else out there who's infringing on your design patent, you sue them normally like you would for any other lawsuit, alleging patent infringement or design patent infringement. But what you're really focusing on is the similarity between somebody else's design, ornamental design on something, and your ornamental design on something. And there's a couple of tests that have sort of made their way through the court system too right now. And it's just worth discussing them for a little bit so people get an idea of how or what makes design patents especially unique. And the courts will apply one of two tests. The main test that they use is something called the ordinary observer test. And basically the court says, in the eyes of an ordinary observer, as this sort of mythical person that's looking at a product or something that they might be buying that has the ornamental features on it, if that person sees the two designs, meaning the one that has the protection and the one that is pretty similar to it, as substantially the same, then you're going to have an instance of design patent infringement. And there's this other kind of funky test out there that's filtered its way through the federal circuit, which is called the point of novelty test. And basically, that you have design patent infringement in that instance when somebody has appropriated the design, including the features which distinguish it from any other types of prior art or what else might make it different between inventions that are pretty close to it before the actual patent was issued. I'm always so surprised, though, that the media makes such a big deal about design patents, and perhaps it's just because of the misconceptions of what's actually being protected. And finally, this is like the last thing that really makes them unique from other types of patents and other forms of intellectual properties, that copyright law will protect original expression that's fixed in some sort of tangible medium. That's basically anything. If you draw a little picture on a paper, you get copyright protection over it instantaneously. But it does not protect functional aspects, and the classic cases you read in law school about this concept usually have to do with art that's also functional. There's a very famous one that's all about bike racks, and an artist had made a bunch of bike racks which I think looked like bikes or something. And A court actually held that there was no copyright protection over them because they also served some sort of functional purpose. And in that case, you don't get any copyright protection. But if you use something like a design patent in order to protect something that's also functional, you can have functionality within an item and only protect the non-functional ornamental features of it with a design patent. Also, you can get protection, utility patent protection over those functional features. So those are just some of the things that are interesting about design patents. But as far as this story goes, the only reason we're really covering it is mostly because the big media seems to make a big deal about design patents when they are in fact not very big deals, at least in the intellectual property world. Was there anything else that surprised you about this, Dominic?
Not so much surprised me. The two patents in question, the two design patents, I think, first of all, the reason the media sort of freaks out is because the word patent is in design patent. They're like, ooh, it's patented. That means no one else can use it. And they don't realize the design patent basically just means it's ornamental entirely. But basically, the one patent is on, if you look at an iPhone, there's this slide to unlock feature that when you have your phone locked, you slide it to unlock. And just to be absolutely clear, Apple isn't patenting the idea of sliding your finger across the screen to unlock it, at least not in these design patents. They're just patenting the actual visual look that you have this sort of circular thing, you have that button there, and you have the text slide to unlock, and then it'll transition into the button on the other side once you've slid it, and that's it. That's all they patented. They don't even patent the transition. They just patent that first state where you have the slide to unlock displaying, and the second state where you've slid it and it's about to unlock. And the other design patent is actually on their keyboard. When you type on their keyboard, when you actually press a key, the buttons will get bigger, just to make it easier for you to type. Again, this is purely visual, purely ornamental, and it's not about the functionality. It's just saying that we make our buttons bigger when you type because it looks prettier. Anything functional about that isn't incorporated in it, but the idea of making buttons bigger within the context of the keyboard looking like their keyboard, that's a design patent. Android does use some sort of similar thing to slide to unlock. I think right now they have a draw a figure to unlock or something like that. And their keyboards do have this same sort of making text bigger feature, but it's unclear whether the keyboard design is similar enough to Apple's design to infringe Apple's design patent. Because again, it's not about functionality, it's purely about the ornamental view.
Right, so that goes back to what I was talking about the two tests that the courts might apply if there was ever a case on this. And as you noted, it has to be substantially similar, which is that main test that the courts use. And that actually seems to be a pretty hard standard to meet because it doesn't mean that it has to be a pure copy, but it means it has to be pretty darn close. And the way that the Android screen looks right now, I think you have three rows of it's basically a matrix of 3x3 dots, and you have to draw a little pattern through the dots with your finger in some way that you set in order to gain access to the phone. So that's a lot different than, say, sliding a little object across the screen. And my best guess would be that it's probably distinct enough from the Apple design so that it's not design patent infringement.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, there isn't too much to talk about with design patents, but and I think it's also interesting that we just don't normally deal with them in the real world, but they are out there, they do exist, and they are sort of this interesting hybrid, I think, between copyright and patent law. And there's also a little corollary to trademark law as well, because you can get something called trade dress protection, which also does not protect functionality or functional items, but it does protect the overall look of something. And I think one of the classic examples used is the Coke bottle. The Coke bottle, with its sort of curvy hips that it has, it is protected under trade dress law. And I think at one point they might have even had a design patent, but like other patents, design patents also expire within a set period of time. But copyright has a pretty long term of life, but trademark law actually is pretty much indefinite as long as you're using the logo or whatever you're protecting by trade dress for as long as it's used in commerce. Any final thoughts, Dominic?
All set.
So, our next story is all about AT&T, and this week they released a pretty short statement, but a statement nonetheless, on how they support the Google and Verizon net neutrality agreement. It wasn't so much an agreement as it was sort of a proposition, a bunch of suggestions for what should be done in the future in terms of legislative enactments to affect some sort of network neutrality rules. And importantly, and we discussed this at length, they left out rules about wireless. And everybody who has a smartphones like Blackberries, tablets, Kindles, and other ebook readers too, a lot of those types of products have access to the internet over cellular technology. And a lot of computers these days, you can also buy EVDO cards for your computer and access the internet as well. And you're going through the wireless carriers in order to access the internet. So there's a big question about whether or not, if there are eventually net neutrality rules which come out, whether or not those rules should apply to the wireless carriers. And AT&T came out this week, and they are supporting the Google Verizon agreement, which says nothing about wireless carriers. And that leaves a lot of questions in people's minds about what exactly should the rules be on wireless carriers. Are the wireless networks so different that they should be treated differently and for purposes of network neutrality? What do you think, Dominic?
Well, AT&T does have a valid point in that wireless networks have a much lower capacity than wired networks do. But their conclusion that follows from that premise, basically their argument is, look, with fiber, you can have a lot of data going through. In fact, AT&T goes through and basically says, fiber can have a theoretical transmission speed as high as 25 million megabits per second. The maximum theoretical of a 4G technology carrier is just 100 megabits per second. That's five extra zeros. Sure, that's true. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we should not have net neutrality on wireless, because I guess I just don't see how their logic follows that, all right, well, some things, sure, we have a much smaller capacity, but back when I first started using the internet, I was using a 28.8 kbps modem, which is slower than anything else that exists today, pretty much. And even with slow speeds, the whole concept of net neutrality doesn't have anything to do with speed. It has the idea of you're not going to be effectively discriminating against certain traffic and giving it priority that it shouldn't have necessarily. Let's say that I'm visiting the AT&T website or using the AT&T music stream instead of buying. I mean, you the they it shouldn't like you shouldn't. It doesn't follow that just because the spectrum is limited and just because the capacity of the network is low, that necessarily we have to give priority to the packets that the carrier likes and not priority to the packets that the user wants.
So maybe I'll play devil's advocate here with you for a little bit. And it seems what AT&T is saying is that wireless technology is really based on the theory that at any given time, only 10% of all users are using the network. And that's how you can achieve the speeds that we get today. But the problem is one of growth, and it's one of how much technology infrastructure is already built in across the country, meaning cell towers and ways to route the traffic into the internet. And if it continues to grow at the pace that it's growing today, that 10% threshold will be exceeded very quickly, and it will become prohibitively expensive for these companies to continue operating. So I guess their argument is that, look, it's really expensive to build out all the infrastructure, building cellular towers across the country in order to keep all the users out there which have cell phones and allow them to connect into the network. But if it's become so popular for people to use smart devices and anything that has any kind of connectivity over wireless in order to get onto the internet, that people are likely to be on it all the time in the future. And because of
Sure.
that, they want to be able to sort of monetize that level of traffic.
Sure, but there's the distinction between regulating traffic in general and regulating traffic by looking at what the packets are and saying, oh, this is a packet that this company paid us money, so we'll make sure that packet gets through, but this other packet, we don't like that packet. It's the distinction. I mean, no one is saying that wireless carriers shouldn't regulate the amount of traffic that goes through their network. No one is saying that at all. They're instead saying that they shouldn't give preferential treatment towards certain packets and not towards others.
So, in other words, you don't think that any type of new scheme in which AT&T would charge certain websites, for instance, websites like YouTube, which arguably take up a large amount of the available bandwidth that these carriers could provide to users, by charging them, it doesn't really, nothing is gained to the end user, you think? This won't help that problem?
I think AT&T already, like, they've gotten rid of their unlimited plans. Everything is metered unless you're grandfathered in under an old unlimited plan. And, I mean, your carriers are doing that more and more. There's nothing wrong with limiting, I mean, it sucks, but there's nothing wrong with limiting people's plans and the amount of data they can get or charging them for more data, because, I mean, most users aren't using that much over the wireless streams. Some people are, and it makes perfect sense to charge those people more. What doesn't make any sense to me is trying to frame this argument in the way that just because our spectrum is limited, that means that we should be able to sell services, prioritize those services, and let's say AT&T, purely for hypothetical purposes, launches their own AT&T Movies on Wireless service, and if they let you watch movies on AT&T's wireless, you can just rent a movie and you just watch it, and it's prioritized. In fact, they have it set up so that someone's watching a movie, every other packet, make way for this packet. So everyone else's service goes to crap because people are watching these AT&T movies. And if you want to stream a movie from Netflix, too bad, you're not going to be prioritized because the AT&T packets priority, movies have priority. And that's frankly pretty damn close to anti-competitive behavior in that you're saying that we're going to give priority to our products and not to the competitors' products on what's a effectively the strength of the internet came from basically the neutral approach that everything goes over the internet. And it really is very worrisome to see companies trending towards this sort of public-private dichotomy, which is the phrasing that Google sort of had in their press release with Verizon. And if wireless gets encompassed into this private internet umbrella, if you will, that's really troubling in that you want users to be able to do whatever they need and want to do with their phones. You don't want to have to use the AT&T movie service because you can't really use Netflix because it's too slow because the AT&T movie services packets are being prioritized. Enough people are using it that there's limited capacity. And the solution is just charge people for more use. If they're using a lot of wireless bandwidth, then charge them for that. Don't try to basically muscle out competitors by prioritizing your packets, or what's more likely is writing deals with companies saying, "Oh, Netflix, here, we'll sign a deal with you that your streaming, that's prioritized, but Blockbuster, they get priority streaming. They've signed a deal with Verizon. So if you want to use Verizon to watch, if you're on Verizon, you should probably be a Blockbuster subscriber." Do you see this sort of pairing off, I guess, of I mean, I personally don't like that the iPhone is only on AT&T's network, for example. And you see this sort of pairing off potentially with more and more services. And if net neutrality isn't going to be the case with wireless networks, then you're going to see this pairing off continue because without net neutrality, it makes perfect business sense. This is effectively free money for AT&T.
Right, and so another thing that either gets misexplained or is often overlooked is that there really isn't, at least there's no direct change in what the actual consumers or the users of these services will pay. This is really all about AT&T's ability to start charging websites and the actual web, the internet content providers, the people who are providing the stuff that the users want to consume.
Yeah, to play for devil's advocate for a moment, this is how it's going down basically in AT&T vice president meetings. "Hey guys, we can charge websites money to give them priority packet prior or packet prioritization on our wireless network. If you care about your users, we'll tell these websites, you'll want to buy our AT&T packet prioritization package. That way your packets will be prioritized and your users will get the best experience possible on AT&T's network. Your competitors will be left in the dust. Our packet prioritizing feature is only $100 per whatever currency, per whatever, however we're going to meter this, or maybe it's just $5 million flat per month or something like that. And that is really attractive from a business perspective for AT&T because they're charging for something they already provide, and by basically restricting who they're providing to, because right now they're providing, quote, packet prioritization to everyone because the first packet through wins, by saying we're going to only provide it to the people who give us money, then they've just created a revenue stream. And that's why this is such a pervasive concept, why carriers, wireless carriers really want this, because it's a lot of money for them. It that doesn't require anything, doesn't require them to do anything. They don't have to expand their network. They don't have to do anything. They just have to send happy letters to these companies and get money from them. That, I mean, from a business perspective, it's a no-brainer. Why would you not do this?
So in the future, though, as consumers, which you and I are, if there are no if net neutrality, okay, let's say that there are some, for whatever reason, these companies do not start charging web content providers for prioritization over the packets. Is it possible then that 5 years from now, or maybe even 10 years from now, that the wireless networks are going to be so overloaded with users trying to access heavy content, for instance, your video example, such that we're going to be charged a lot more just because there's nobody else that these companies like AT&T can sort of leverage the bandwidth against?
I honestly find that pretty doubtful, simply because technology is going to keep increasing. We're going to figure out, in AT&T's press release, when their comparison between the theoretical speed of Ethernet and the theoretical speed of wireless networks, they basically neglect to point out that they're comparing apples to oranges, and that they're comparing the theoretical speed of light, basically transfer-based compared to the next generation of wireless technology, 4G. They're not talking about the theoretical maximum of a spectrum. It's just that we don't know how to extract that power out of the spectrum yet. So,
one last thing that is probably worth hitting here is that right now there are no rules that really would restrict a wireless carrier like AT&T from imposing charges on prioritization for certain packets on any of the web content companies. What's preventing them from doing it right now? Why haven't they done it if this is such a big issue? Do you have any idea? I guess what I'm really trying to ask is why would we need affirmative rules which impose a network neutrality requirement rather than letting sort of the market decide, sort of the free market idea, that this thing will sort of solve itself as time goes on?
Well, I personally actually think that the market will punish companies that try to do this just because, and even though that'll make them a lot of money, assuming every wireless company doesn't do it, and that's the risk, since we only really have four major carriers in the United States, it's very possible for every wireless carrier to do that. See, the problem with the market will decide angle, which usually I favor, is that we don't really have much of a free market with wireless carriers in the U.S. because we have four major carriers and three big regional carriers, and that's pretty much it. Even accounting for the big regional carriers, that's like seven companies competing with each other. That's not a lot of competition. That's not enough to really make the market free in the sense that what's best for the consumer is going to prevail, because it's possible for self-interest from each of those to, they can be greedy, and since they're all greedy, there's no one who's going to break no carrier that's going to be like, oh, well, we can actually make more money by not embracing net neutrality because we'll get a lot more customers.
And this is a lot about competition, too. The idea of the web as it grew up was all about anybody can get onto the web. It just takes a web server, basically, or some computer that's capable of running the correct ports that access the web so that people can look at the server as long as it's running a website and view the website content. And you could grow from that, just a small operation that's run out of somebody's garage, into a giant company like Hewlett-Packard or Google. And it seems that if you start imposing these new points where companies can be charged and hit up for huge charges on prioritization of packets, you lose that competitive aspect, and it's you won't have these companies that sort of come out of a person's garage anymore. It's going to take a lot more money in order to become big, and especially if the with regard to wireless traffic, if the trends continue, I think the latest figure that I read from the articles that AT&T was citing was that growth is at 120% in the last couple of years for wireless devices on accessing the internet, and that's expected to continue, if not increase, as time goes on. So if we continue to see these trends increase, I think that there is at least an interest from just the market aspect of seeing more competitive companies come through and offer better and different services than do the ones that currently exist. So for that reason, we might want to see when as soon as the government, and hopefully the government is paying attention to all the noise that's been made in the last couple of weeks, as soon as they determine that there is a need for some sort of rules out there which govern what exactly these companies who effectively control the access to the internet can do, when as soon as they create some positive legislation that creates these rules, then hopefully that will be the right time for the move the actually having the rules rather than the sort of the free market concept that we're currently riding on. So I guess we'll see what happens in the future, and I guarantee you that we're going to see a lot more commentary in the coming weeks about this. I think always at the point where it gets onto CNN, it starts to be a big topic and not so much a niche topic like we've been reading about at least for like the last 4 or actually 5 or 6 years now, I think I've been reading topics on net neutrality. So, unless you have any other thoughts, Dominic, you can lead us right into our third story.
Yeah, just one quick closing point. Another thing to be worried about is basically market distortion, because remember, the internet isn't really separated between wireless and wired. And if we're going to have net neutrality imposed on wired networks but not on a wireless network, that's going to really do weird things with just market competition between wireless and wired services. So,
Great point, actually.
anyway, moving into our next story, it's the Oracle and Google lawsuit. There's a lot in this story. It basically broke a couple weeks ago. The big thing is that Oracle bought Sun earlier this year, I believe, and with Sun came patents that related to Java. Google, as you know, makes the Android platform, and the Android platform includes in it something called a Java virtual machine that they call Dalvik. This Java virtual machine was supposedly reverse engineered by Google to operate just like a Java virtual machine by a team of engineers in a closed room with no access to Sun's actual code or functionality, or not code or the actual Sun product, but just with specifications in terms of what it did. Basically, the way reverse engineering works is you get one team of engineers to very carefully document what a product does, and then you take another team of engineers who have not communicated with that team or seen that product, lock them in a room, and give them the specs and tell them build something that does this. It's very important that that second team of engineers does not see the actual product or touch it or deal with it in any way. They have to reverse engineer it basically from scratch, getting the functionality entirely to be very, very similar without having any of the internals be different. That's one of Oracle's claims against Google. They claim copyright infringement, basically based on the virtual machine itself. They also have a bunch of patent claims. The patent claims, though they've been getting more press, it'll be interesting to see whether many of these patents will hold up in court. Some of them seem very general. Stuff like controlling access to a resource. Ooh, that's a patent right there. Or protection domains to provide security in a computer system. It'll be interesting to see whether these patents actually hold up, but the reverse engineering claim, and basically, Google is suing, a or suing Go Oracle is suing Google over the Java virtual machine inside the Android phone operating system, the one that Google publishes and distributes, and the virtual machine that Google reverse engineered or allegedly reverse engineered with these clean room engineers to create the Dalvik virtual machine. And the Dalvik virtual machine that they reverse engineered necessarily violates these Java-based patents because it does the same thing. It does the things that are protected by these patents because that's what the Java Virtual Machine does. And since they duplicated the functionality of the Java Virtual Machine, they are necessarily going to infringe these patents if the patents are valid. And that's going to be the big catch, because a lot of these patents, prior art is probably, I mean, 2000, 1999, 2008, 2003, 2005, and 2000 on the seven patents that Oracle is asserting against Google. Those are all pretty recent, and Java was invented in 1993, I'm sorry, 1995. And a lot of these ideas were out there, so we're going to see some prior art issue dates, prior art potentialities in the lawsuit, if they even go to trial. Personally, I would not bet money on seeing this go to trial. I can see this sort of settling out of court or potentially a cross-licensing agreement with Google and Oracle. Google basically paying Oracle a bunch of money and saying, "Here you go. We can now we've immunized all Android applications from this lawsuit." That would be the ideal situation for the Android platform. The worst-case scenario would be Google going to court and losing, but I don't think either company really wants a lawsuit. I think Oracle is in this for the money in terms of what they can extract in terms of cross-licensing or from settlement. It would also be bad for the Android platform if Google settled the lawsuit for a large amount of money and didn't do any cross-licensing scheme. Basically, they would say, "You're not going to sue us on this matter," but then Oracle would be free to take that settlement and say, "Hey, look, Google settled with us. Handset manufacturers, you guys are liable too because you've been distributing products using the Android Dalvik virtual machine that Google just settled with us instead of taking us to court," which means that they don't think that they could have won or didn't think the money was worth it winning. So Oracle would be able to attack them on that regard.
Wow, that was a mouthful.
Yeah, it's a
Yeah.
pretty complex story, but it's a pretty cool story, at least from someone who's interested in both software and patents.
So, I haven't paid too much attention to the story. I certainly haven't gotten a chance to read the complaint, but do you have any familiarity with what the actual patents are? What the claims are in the patents?
Sure, and the complaint is actually a very comical read because it doesn't tell you anything of any importance effectively. It just says, "We believe or we are asserting that Google has infringed this patent. Google has infringed this patent by distributing this product and selling it voluntarily and purposefully." That's the end of that. Count one. Count two, Google has infringed this patent. And they don't tell you how they've infringed the patent or anything of that variety. They just say it's infringed the patent. It's infringed this patent too. Hey, they've infringed this patent too. And it's a very interesting read because it's very boilerplate, very, I mean, all patent infringement complaints look pretty much the same. You don't know what infringement happened. That's something that comes out in litigation. Something that goes to litigation. As for the
Yeah.
actual patent, which is to address that part of your question, one of them, for example, is interpreting functions using a hybrid, utilizing a hybrid of virtual and native machine instructions. And really quickly, the way Java virtual machines used to work is Java was a purely interpreted platform, which meant that it was, well, purely interpreted, but Java would compile into something called bytecode, which would then be interpreted. So a really, really quick primer on how compilers work. Compilers. A classic compiler, saying taking something from C++ and compiling it, will put something into machine instructions. So basically, what assembly code gets written into. So it works specifically for that machine. But Java's big selling point was that Java was cross-platform. So what Java did, and this was a pretty big deal in 1995, was they were like, "All right, we'll create our own little virtual machine. This machine doesn't exist, and we'll compile to this bytecode that runs on this virtual machine, and then the Java virtual machine that we distribute looks at this bytecode and then on the fly interprets it and then runs it." So basically, what that means is that they would get the benefits of cross-platform by having it go everywhere while also getting some of the benefits of somewhat of compilation, even though they weren't really doing compilation. They did just-in-time compilation, if you will. That's basically how they marketed it. So they kind of got the best of both worlds. Now, how does this come into the Google Oracle thing? Well, Android used to do, before they added Froyo, the latest patch of Android 2.2, they would just do this sort of bytecode virtual machine, and that's not at issue in the patent case. But Sun, and now Oracle, has a patent on the hybridization of virtual and native machine instructions. So basically this says, okay, we can have bytecode sometimes, but sometimes in the same program we'll have native machine instructions for stuff that needs to be really fast. We'll compile it directly to that machine. So we're trading off a little bit of cross-platformness, but when you have something like a phone where you can customize some of the native programs to that particular platform, you can have this hybrid of virtual and native machine instructions, and Sun and Oracle has a patent on this idea of using both a native and a virtual machine instruction in the same program. Now, Google wasn't infringing this until the latest version of Android, where they added this exact functionality in. So,
interesting. What do you think that the odds are that Google develops something that is entirely different than the technology that's actually claimed within the Sun Oracle patents?
Since the whole idea of the Dalvik virtual machine was to recreate the way that the Java virtual machine works, if the patents are valid, then Google is infringing them. I think that this case, though, is going to come down to whether the patents are valid. And I think Google's best chances will come basically in trying to look at prior art and trying to say, look, sure, we infringe these patents, but guess what? The patents aren't valid, therefore we can't infringe the patents because you can't infringe something that's invalid. And the patents are invalid because other people came up with these ideas before or they were obvious. All sorts of grounds that they can use to invalidate the patents.
Interesting. So the one thing I did find in this case is actually that this isn't the first time that Sun has tried to enforce these patents. And I don't know if it was these particular patents or patents that were also related to virtual machines in some other way, but there was a suit against Microsoft, I think, that settled back in 2004, but it was probably related to activity around 2001, 2002, and 2003. And in fact, Microsoft ended up settling that for a huge sum of money.
Yes.
I think it was $1.6 billion, as a matter of fact.
So this actually is very important because so the way Java works, the way Sun would deal with Java, is that they would say, all right, you're going to write something that uses Java? Great. We'll license you to use our patents as long as you comply with the Java specifications, because we want Java to be the premier cross-platform development choice. We want people to know that they write their code on Java, it'll run everywhere. Write once, run everywhere. That was their slogan, that was their big marketing push. And so they basically said, all right, if you're going to, we'll license you to use our patents as long as you actually are compatible everywhere. And how Microsoft got in trouble was they said, sure, we'll be compatible everywhere, and then they promptly turned around and made stuff that only run on Windows, which completely defeats the point. And Sun basically took them to court and said, look, you just signed this agreement, but you violated the agreement, which means that you're now infringing our patents because since you're violating the agreement, we're not licensing these patents to you. You have to pay us
money. Oh, wow. That's a really interesting point.
Yeah, Google's basically doing the same thing. They recreated the Java VM, so they didn't go to Sun and say, hey, we want to write a Java VM. Can you license our patents? We'll build it ourselves. They didn't do that. They reverse-engineered things, and so they don't have that patent license.
Interesting.
And that's really at the heart of this lawsuit, at least from the patent angle, that Google went and reverse engineered their own Java virtual machine, and because they did that, it's necessarily going to work like the actual Java virtual machine, but because they reverse engineered it, they didn't get the patent grant from Sun that would prevent this entire issue from happening. Oracle, I mean, we can speculate why Oracle's actually suing Google, but That'll be just speculation, because I mean, the obvious answer is because they think they infringed their patents, but it's really not so much about the patents, it's more about Oracle trying to, at least in my opinion, Oracle is trying to reassert its dominance over the mobile space. They're worried that the Android platform has become very, very fragmented, and because of the way Google has sort of overseen things, you're going to see Java virtual machines that don't, these reverse engineer Java virtual machines that don't have that write once, run anywhere philosophy. Developers are having to customize their applications to potentially different versions of phones. Correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not an Android user, but that's my understanding. And Oracle doesn't like that and thinks that they can get a lot of money from Google in the process. So.
Yeah, well, this definitely comes down to the issue of a lot of zeros with some commas in it, meaning money, I think, but probably more correctly, as you noted, this is probably a little bit about market share too. So, also, how close exactly does the Google creation actually have to be to what's claimed in the Sun patents in order for there actually to be a colorable instance of infringement?
It has to read on the claims, at least one claim. And the claim has to be valid. So what does read on the claim mean? It means that a court is going to basically, there's this thing called a Markman hearing where they decide how to interpret the claim. This is probably the most important part of a patent litigation lawsuit because the court will basically say this word means this, this word means this, and then everything follows from that basically. There's a little bit of room you can argue around, but basically, if a big definition goes the wrong way, you're screwed.
Yeah, and you gave a really great explanation of the technology, I think. I especially understood exactly what you were talking about for once rather than trying to understand it myself, which is always much more difficult. But the funny thing is like even though you can have somebody who can explain the technology really well, often what's claimed in the patent might end up being different after the Markman hearing just because you go through that whole claim construction process. And when there's actual meaning that is, you know, that the actual terms of the patent are given meaning for what the invention actually is, it often might be just a tiny bit different, but enough in a way that could make things either broader for what's claimed in the patent or the patented invention, or sometimes even narrower. But again, that would all come down to the actual Markman hearing when that comes into play.
And I guess this patents aren't made to just claim the invention. A good patent attorney doesn't just claim the invention. He or she will try to claim the invention and as much space as around the invention as possible. Basically, a good patent attorney doesn't just look at your invention and say, oh, okay, well, I'll write some claims and make that happen. Then they look at your invention and say, okay, I know what your invention is, but what's the concept behind the invention? What's the whole idea that led to this invention? How can we expand this idea? How can we see other ways of implementing this idea? How can we get to that really core essence of the idea and protect all that space while making our way around stuff that already exists? So if you sort of imagine a big circle on a X and Y axis, you can sort of modify the circle around existing space. It's sort of a map. You're trying to claim as much territory as possible without getting in other territory that already exists. So you want the biggest grant of space, and the invention might actually just be a very small bit inside that space. So the claims are typically far broader than the invention. For example, the hybridization virtual machine thing that we talked about, the first independent claim for that is in a computer system, a method for increasing the execution speed of virtual machine instructions at runtime. The method comprising receiving a first virtual machine instruction, generating, at runtime, a new virtual machine instruction that represents or references one or more native instructions that can be executed instead of said virtual machine instruction, said first virtual machine instruction, and executing said new virtual machine instruction instead of first said virtual machine instruction. So basically the concept there is it's not just technology specific, it's saying the whole idea of replacing a virtual machine instruction with a native instruction in any circumstance. And then there's a whole bunch of dependent claims. The way patent litigation usually goes down, so to speak, is if the independent claim is seen too broad, then you can incorporate a dependent claim, or you can basically, as long as one claim stands, the patent's still valid. And the reason you have the dependent claims is to basically, for lack of a better phrase, cover your ass so that if something does go down, then you have some protection. So it's basically a planned retreat, if you will. You've claimed all this territory, but you're not sure you're going to be able to hold all of it. So you're going to basically build these little dependent claims, which you can sort of imagine as a set of concentric walls or overlapping walls. That okay, if there's a breach here, we'll still protect this area.
Patent drafting is such a complex beast, and patent attorneys, especially patent prosecutors, that is the people who actually write these claims, are they're experts at doing this. I mean, it is such an art to actually draft patent language and it's definitely not really my strong point. And certainly, reading patents is not my strong point. But this is the kind of thinking that goes into this, and these are the situations that they prepare for. So we'll just have to see how this all holds up while the litigation sort of comes to terms.
Yeah, I imagine there'll be negotiations. Right now, Google's like, "Oh, we haven't. I mean, what are you guys suing us for?" I'm sure there'll be closed door meetings. I honestly would expect a cross licensing agreement to come out of this. I would be shocked if this goes to litigation, just because it's going to be incredibly expensive for both companies.
Yeah, interesting stuff there, and from the claim language that you're reading, it sounds like very broad claims are at issue in this. And when you talk about very broad claims, you also run into the risk, as you noted, of having them invalidated. It's much easier to invalidate something that's written very broadly because there's more likely to be prior art on it, rather than something that's a very very narrow invention claim.
Anything else on this story?
Nope, but I'll be interested to see if a settlement agreement is announced sometime in the next 6 months.
It's not gonna happen that fast. 2 years, year and a half, at least, honestly.
The parties will end up probably drawing it out and spending a little bit of money, but not a whole lot of money. And finally, when push comes to shove and they have hashed out exactly what the claims are and what it is that Sun and Oracle believe to be the actual instance of infringement that's going on.
So I guess that closes out our podcast for this week. I'm Dominic Rabia, and with me today was
David O'Brien.
Thank you all for listening. Please be sure to visit our website at technicallylegal.org. Follow us on Twitter at @techlegal. And if you have any comments or suggestions, please feel free to email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org. Have a great week.